Coming up on Triangulation, I talked to Charlie Jane Anders. She is the author of The City in the Middle of the Night. She's also the award-winning author of All the Birds in the Sky, Choir Boy, and so many other books, and formerly of IO9, the science fiction website.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Triangulation, episode 391, recorded Friday, March 29th, 2019. Charlie Jane Anders, The City in the Middle of the Night. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where every week we get to talk to the most fascinating people working in technology, writing about technology, or writing sci-fi. I'm Megan Maroney, and today I am very excited to talk to Charlie Jane Anders. She is an author, a podcaster, a journalist, formerly a writer at IO9, that was the sci-fi site IO9, and then award-winning writer of All the Birds in the Sky and Choir Boy. And we're going to talk mostly about her new book, The City in the Middle of the Night. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I first want to start, just how were you inspired to write sci-fi? Like when did you start writing?
Yeah, I can't remember a time when I didn't love science fiction. Like my earliest memories of being a kid are of like being obsessed with Doctor Who and Star Trek and Star Wars and, reading The Phantom Tollbooth and reading A Wrinkle in Time and, other stuff like that and comics and stuff. And I don't know. And when I was, really little, I had a huge learning disability. So I had this special education teacher who worked with me a lot to get me able to basically do the basic stuff they needed me to do in elementary school. Like I was flunking out of first grade, basically. And she got me doing, doing repetitive exercises. But the reward for that was if I figure out how to like actually make words on a page or whatever and do basic math and stuff, I would get to write a stage play that we actually had performed at the school. And later she had me make a fake newspaper. And, I was always just making up weird stories and stuff. That was kind of part of how I got through stuff. And I remember vividly being like in third or fourth grade and just writing lots and lots and lots of Doctor Who fanfic in like my little school exercise books instead of whatever I was actually supposed to be doing. And so I think that was like those were my first writing projects, was like kind of weird, silly, fantastical stuff and Doctor Who fanfic.
Well, I heard you say that that science fiction is the literature of problem solving.
Yeah. That's something that that's one of my like kind of maxims, I guess, because I think it's really true. And I think that, I think that sometimes we forget that. And I think that that's part of what makes science fiction so powerful, especially now that we have a lot of problems that we don't have easy solutions for. And, it used to be that science fiction, everybody kind of knew that science fiction was about like scientists and explorers who are like problem solvers, who are kind of can do, resourceful, fix it kind of people who just go into a situation and build a rocket ship out of like parts from a toaster or whatever, and like they just get the job done. And I feel like that's part of the lifeblood of science fiction to this day. And it's good that we have different kinds of characters, we have different kinds of heroes in science fiction, but I still, when I read science fiction books, I still get really excited and happy when I see characters who are figuring stuff out and solving problems and kind of working through stuff and being competent. And, I feel like the appeal of something like The Martian, which is very much a story about problem solving, and every single kind of twist in The Martian is this guy being presented with another problem and then solving it. I feel like that's part of what a lot of people, myself included, love about science fiction, is that it's not about just kind of running away from our problems. It's about like figuring out a solution and making it happen.
And so a lot of your books are about the future. And as we were talking before, your podcast, Our Opinions Are Correct, you were talking about futurism,
right,
on a recent episode. And I was thinking about that. And, one of the things you said, one of the definitions, I think Rose Eveleth, your guest, said that one of the definitions of futurist is someone trying to make the future a better place.
Huh. Yeah.
I think she said that. Did I make that up?
I mean, that sounds yeah. right. I love that.
And I
love that.
I spoke to Cory Doctorow earlier and I said, you know, I was kind of thought of him as a futurist, like just in terms of his activism role and a science
right.
fiction. But he sort of took a little umbrage to that. Like,
oh,
I
yeah?
don't think of myself as a futurist.
Huh.
I think there's sort of a negative connotation sometimes to futurism. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that there's a bunch of parts to that. One of the things is that a lot of science fiction writers don't want to be boxed into this role of like predicting the future. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of sci-fi writers will very emphatically say, I don't predict the future. Science fiction, even if it takes place in the future, is always about the present. It's always about this moment. And, you know, we don't want to get stuck into this thing of like being kind of scored based on whether our predictions came true or not or mm-hmm. whatever. And like, so I think people, there's that. And then there's, maybe there is this connotation now that futurism is a lot of, you know, that it's a lot of kind of pie in the sky prognosticating of like, you know, 5 years from now, we'll all have removable heads and we'll be able to like walk on the ceiling and like, you know, we'll live for 1,000 years and just like, you know, there is a school of futurism that kind of trades in kind of unrealistically either rosy scenarios or unrealistically disastrous scenarios. And, you know, there's also the failure mode of futurism that just kind of extrapolates in a very straight line from whatever is happening at this exact moment. Like, you know, every trend line will continue in a straight line forever. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think of myself as a futurist because I think that that's a really specific discipline. But I do think about the future a lot. I do, you know, try to read other people thinking about the future. And I try to imagine plausible futures that feel like they could happen, not that I think that they will happen.
And do you ever write about futures that you don't want to happen? I mean, I know that I heard you talking about how you wrote a short story about drones,
right.
drone strikes before they were a thing. But then by the time the story was published, they were a thing.
Yeah. And that's a thing that happens a lot. If you write about like near future science fiction stuff and near future developments, you will get overtaken by events. This happens to Charles Stross a lot, I feel like, and it happens to other people I know. And people are having to rewrite their stuff at the last minute in real time because, you know, things like Brexit and, you know, just huge, like, I feel like there's a bunch of things that I've written where by the time they were published, they felt less like futurism and more like just describing here and now. And things often happen faster than you think they will. And, you know, I think that there's a huge role for writing dystopian fiction and fiction about bad futures that we want to warn people about. And I definitely have done that. I've done that a bunch of times. I most notably, this story that came out a couple of years ago called Don't Press Charges and I Won't Sue was like an explicitly kind of dystopian story that was kind of warning and kind of trying to prepare us for like a terrible future. And it was kind of exaggerated and a little bit surreal, but also very much trying to like point to, yeah, this would be bad if this mm-hmm. happened, kind of.
So, well, I want to talk about technology, like the relationship to technology in your books. You have a line in All the Birds in the Sky, humans build machines like spiders build spin silk.
Yeah.
Hey. And when I read that, I just can't really stop thinking about it. Let's talk a little bit about the role of technology in your books.
Yeah, I mean, I love technology, obviously, and, you know, I use technology constantly. I used to work with all the folks at Gizmodo, so I kind of got to talk to them about, like, what they were excited about in the world of technology. And I don't know. I mean, that line in All the Birds in the Sky was kind of part of me trying to, like, that book is specifically about, like, science versus magic, which kind of translates into, you know, technology versus nature. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's something that I think about a lot in terms of how are we going to be able to continue to be a technological society without destroying our own natural habitat? Like, you know, and that is, I think, a dilemma that humans are facing right now. And it's something that we don't, you know, that we haven't really faced up to as much as we should. We need to get better at building technologies that don't, you know, destroy the environment that are carbon neutral, that you know, don't pollute. And I think that's something that we're kind of dragging our feet on. And so that's a big part of how I think about technology, is just like, how can we continue to have technology in a world where the byproducts of our technology are causing a lot of serious issues.
And what about just the people who sort of see nature and technology being opposites? Like, oh, get off your screen and go outside. You know, we're like that sort of thing. I know you have sort of a different idea of nature and technology. Talk about that a little bit.
I mean, you know, I think nature is a concept that humans invented. And like, it's our word for things that we didn't build. And actually, you know, Anna Lee, my partner who works with me on all our opinions and they're correct, you know, she is constantly talking to me about like these archaeological studies that she's read that basically show that actually humans have been terraforming Earth for a lot longer than we realized. Like, the forests are largely, you know, the rainforest was created by humans, I guess. And like, you know, I think that for tens of thousands of years, humans have been messing around with this, with our own planet, and kind of, you know, cultivating it and planting stuff and moving stuff around and introducing species all over the place. So it's not like there's some untouched state of nature outside of the cities that's just like humans have never messed around with it. Everything on this planet has been affected by humans since long before we had like engines and you know, since long before we started, you know, building machines as we know them today. So I think that we are part of nature. Humans are part of nature. We're not separate from nature. Technology is not separate from nature. It's, you know, it's just continuing a process that we began a long time ago. But on the other hand, and I think part of what I try to get at in All the Birds in the Sky is that opposition between nature and the human world is kind of a false distinction. Mm. But at the same time, you know, like, I think somebody actually says this in All the Birds in the Sky, we have a very limited habitat that we can live in. We can't live in conditions past a certain point, like if it gets too hot or if there's not enough water or if the air is, you know, polluted. We can't live anymore. And so we're destroying our own habitat. And that's really what it comes down to. Mm. And, you know, yeah. And I like to walk around outside. I don't know.
I like to walk around outside with my phone.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to talk about your book, but I want to first, before we talk about that, IO9, that was previously a Gawker website,
right?
Sci-fi and science.
Yeah.
And were you one of the founders, or were you the first hire?
I guess I was the first hire. Okay. Like, basically, Annalie was hired to start this site. Annalie Newitz was hired to start this site. And she brought me on really early. She and I had already collaborated before on some other projects, including an anthology called She's Such a Geek that was, like, first-person stories of, like, women in science, technology, and geeky culture and stuff.
Is that still available?
I think it is still in print. I still get royalty checks.
Oh, good.
Like, every now and then, like, a check shows up, and I always think about how they weren't sure if anybody was going to buy this book, and I'm like, well, I guess that worked out okay. Yeah, I mean, and I still run into the people who were in the book, and, like, it was a really amazing group of people.
What year was that?
That was 2007, I think.
Yeah, where there were only five women geeks at that time in the world.
I mean, that was the thing. We did this anthology, She's Such a Geek, and the publisher who had asked both of us separately if we wanted to do a project, it was this feminist press called Seal Press, and they were like, okay, you know, can you suggest other books that are similar to this one that so that we know that there's a market? And we looked, and there was basically nothing at the time. Like, no, there was no books, no documentaries, no media of any type about female geeks in like 2006, 2007.
Wow.
And so we came back to the publisher and we're like, we can't show you any other stuff, but that just proves that there's a huge need for this mm-hmm. book. And they were like, well, the publishing mindset is always like, if somebody hasn't already done it, then obviously there's no market for
right.
it.
Right, and that's crazy.
And so we finally convinced them to do it, and we put out an open call for submissions, and we were just inundated. We got hundreds of essays from women about, you know, being in science and being in tech and being gamers, being comics geeks. And, you know, it was just amazing to read like a few hundred first person stories of women's geeky experiences and their passions. And it was amazing.
Do you ever think about writing a follow-up to that?
I don't know. I mean, it would be cool to do that,
yeah.
Like 10 years later or 12 years later.
Right, to do the next generation or to even follow up on those women.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that would be really interesting. I don't know. We should definitely think about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she hired me to work on io9, and you know, I actually had to try out. There were a few other people who tried out. We had like a blog that was password protected, which only like 3 people could read. And so we were all kind of, it was called Blogging in the Dark. And so a few of us were blogging in the dark, and luckily I was able to win over the other, you know, folks at Gawker. And, you know, so I was on board before the blog launched. And by the time we did launch, I think we had hired one other person.
And so it still exists. You're not there anymore.
Yeah.
Annalie is still working there, or she's just at Ars Technica?
No, she left io9 before I did.
Oh, okay.
She became editor of Gizmodo for a little while, and then she moved on, and she's not really at Ars Technica either anymore.
Okay. But we're talking about you.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
So it was science and sci-fi mixed in. And so were you more interested in the sci-fi or the science or both?
I mean, I love the science. My background was definitely the sci-fi end of it. And, you know, I was kind of hired to cover, you know, movies, TV, books, comics, as a science fiction geek or whatever. And Annalie was the one who really kind of, I think their idea was originally that it was just going to be science fiction. Mm-hmm. And Annalie was like, no, it has to have science as well. It has to have half science coverage and half science fiction coverage, because that's how you really get this kind of interesting conversation going between what's happening in science fiction and what's happening in the real world of science. And that's how you really get to see how the real world is becoming more science fictional, mm-hmm. while science fiction is also becoming more relevant. And so it was just a really, like, having that mix in there was just amazing. And, you know, getting to read so many science articles, getting to edit so many science articles was like a huge, like, you know, boon to me as a science fiction writer. Like, I learned so much during that time. And just having both on the page all the time was just, like, so exciting.
Yeah. So, and what about, how do you feel about how science, the belief in science is changing right now? I mean, so many people are just, like, doubting basic science facts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess somewhere around where we are right now in, you know, the North Bay area, there was, like, a big measles outbreak, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like I read about that a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I think they were maybe that was New York, where they were quarantining people who hadn't been vaccinated.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, it's really scary to me that, like, something as basic as vaccination is people are pushing back on it, and people aren't believing in it. And, you know, there is a lot of, like, anti-science kind of feeling among people right now. And I think it's just, I don't know, I guess people feel threatened by how quickly things have changed. They feel like things are out of control, and they want to be in control of their own situation. And so they just, you know, and it kind of dovetails with this sort of anti-expert thing. You know, it's like Isaac Asimov used to say, this belief that, like, my ignorance is as important as your knowledge, kind of.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then there is the fact that right now science is warning us, like, super loudly that we have to do something about climate change, and people don't want to hear that. And so it makes them just kind of doubt science in general, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it would be way easier to believe that climate change doesn't exist.
Yeah. I mean, that would be great if that turned out to be real.
Right. So, okay, let's talk about your book.
Yay.
So it is, it takes place on a planet that has, that doesn't tilt, doesn't spin.
Yeah, well, it's a tidally locked planet,
right,
which means that its period of rotation is the same as its period of orbit, which is basically the same as the way that the moon is tidally locked to Earth. So we only see one face of the moon all the time. Like, there's like the dark side of the moon, which we never get to see. And so it would be the same thing if, like, a planet always had one face turn to the sun, and it does actually orbit and rotate. It's just that the orbital period and the rotation period are the same.
Oh, okay. So that there's a dark and a light, a night and a day, which is a place.
Yeah, they're places rather than times. And I, you know, the poor copy editor who worked on this book, we asked her to, like, go through and make sure that at no point do people ever use words like today, tomorrow, yesterday, you know, hour, minute, you know, any words for time from Earth, because I didn't want to have any of that in the book. I wanted day and night to be just places, not times.
Mm-hmm. And so why the title Elocked Planets? What inspired you to write about that?
It really started when I was working on IO9. And like I said, I got to read and edit so much science coverage during that time. And I was just like, I was getting to talk to scientists more, and I was getting to like learn about science from our coverage and just from reading stuff in general. And it was an amazing education. And basically, I mean, that period when I was working on IO9 was kind of, in a lot of ways, it was the golden age for exoplanet discovery. We were discovering a lot of exoplanets. We were learning more about exoplanets. And the thing that I kept hearing from scientists was that if humans do manage to colonize a planet outside of our solar system, it will probably be tidally locked. And that boils down to the fact that, I guess, most of the stars, at least in our part of the galaxy, are red dwarfs. And if you were going to be close enough to the star to get liquid water and to be warm enough for people to live, it's going to be so close, because the star is cooler, it's going to be so close that you get pulled into a tidally locked orbit. And so it's just basically the law of averages says that if we do manage to get outside the solar system, we're going to be colonizing a planet like the one in my book. Maybe not exactly like, but the same kind of planet.
So the planet is so fascinating. The world that you've built is so fascinating. So, you know, there's the one side that is so regimented.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that, you know, scientists talked about to me in relation to tidally locked planets, and one of the things that I kind of obsessed about was, how do you keep track of the passage of time? How do you kind of have a normal sleep schedule? And, you know, basically, if the sun doesn't rise or set, and there's just like permanent day over here and permanent night over there, how do you know when to sleep? How do you know when to go to work? And how do you kind of keep that normal human pattern that we have on Earth? And I sort of thought that, you know, there would be people on this planet who would really believe that if we don't keep to a strict circadian rhythm and like all sleep at the same time, we're kind of going to stop being human in some sense. And over time, I mean, I think they've been on this planet for like 500 years or something. Over time, that has turned into this really regimented society where everybody does everything at the same time, because they're so obsessed with trying to stay human and trying to hold on to this circadian rhythm that we had on Earth. And so, you know, and then there's another city where basically people who rebelled against that super regimented society went, and they were like, we're just going to live in harmony with the planet. We're going to sleep whenever we feel like it. We're going to work whenever we feel like it. And we're going to kind of, you know, because the sky never changes and everything is just constant, we're just going to kind of go with that and, you know, live in a state of nature, kind of.
And have great parties.
And have amazing parties. And like, you know, and I wrote some scenes which aren't in the book where people kind of talk about like some this sort of philosophy that they have of like, you know, how we almost have a duty as like people on this new planet reinventing ourselves. We almost have a duty to be total hedonists and just like live for pleasure, live for whatever makes you feel good, because, you know, we're living on a planet where there's no constants, or there is a constant. The sky is constant, but there's no like, there's none of the things that we took for granted on Earth. And so we should just kind of do what feels good. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the scenes where they talk about that didn't end up in the book, but I feel like you kind of get that feeling anyway.
Yeah. It's like Las Vegas.
It's a lot like Vegas on another planet. And
yeah.
It kind of becomes a little scarily like Vegas at certain points, I think.
Right. Or that feeling like when you've been in, you go in to see a movie and it's daytime and like,
yeah,
you come out and it's night.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No, seriously.
Yeah. That just,
yeah, I mean, I've had that, like if I go to a matinee or something, or sometimes I used to go to critic screenings that were in the middle of the day, and you come outside and you're like, what is this? You know, it's super weird to come out and be super bright outside.
So I loved like I said, the world building, the scenes, the crocodiles, which are not really crocodiles, which we can talk about. But for me, like I love science fiction, like, but I'm always, the most important part is the relationships to me in a book. Like, yeah. And I loved the relationships and these characters who were flawed, and especially Bianca, who
yeah, they're
so
a little flawed.
Bossy and selfish.
Oh my God, yeah.
But she's not a caricature. You know, she is, you know, she's still worthy of love, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I really sweated over those characters. And like, honestly, I mean, there's a maxim that somebody came up with, this woman, Dorothy J. Haight, came up with on the internet like 20 years ago, that basically like the seven deadly words of like any story are, I don't care what happens to these people. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if you don't care what happens to the people, it doesn't matter if the world is amazing. It doesn't matter if the story is super clever, if there's like cool plot twists. If the people aren't interesting, if you don't care about them, then it's just not going to work. And so, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, I kind of started out with this thing of like, it's a tightly locked planet. There are creatures in the darkness who are intelligent, but nobody's ever managed to communicate with them, except that this one girl goes into the darkness and learns how to communicate with those creatures. And that's how she survives being in the dark. And I was sort of like, you know, I had like a period of like two and a half years where I was had that world and I was building out the world, but I didn't have the characters or the story and I hadn't figured that out. And it was kind of driving me nuts. And like, finally I was like, okay, so who is this girl? Why does she go into the dark? Why does she meet these creatures? And like, you know, I had a version where she goes on like a hunting expedition where they're hunting the crocodiles for meat, but I didn't find that very sympathetic. So finally, right around the time I left IO9, I came up with this idea that she has this best friend. Sophie has this best friend, Bianca, and she makes this huge sacrifice for Bianca, which turns out to be much bigger than she expected. And that's how she ends up getting sent into the night. And then I just got kind of sucked into building out that relationship between the two of them. And eventually kind of it went to some kind of dark places. And the more it went to dark places, the more I was like, okay, we really have to like care about Bianca. She can't just be this one-dimensional character. And I kind of identify with Bianca. I can be a little bit bossy. I can be kind of, I can be very outgoing. I can go into a situation and just be like, hey, it's the party, you know, whatever.
Right. You have nice clothes, nice dresses.
I have nice clothes. Yeah. I'm like, you know, I come from kind of a privileged background. I kind of identify with Bianca and I kind of wanted the reader to maybe identify with Bianca because she does make some kind of not great choices. And I wanted it to be like, this isn't just because she's like evil or because she's like whatever. It's, she's just human, you know?
Right. And I think it's interesting because I think we're so much more willing to accept that flawed man.
Seriously.
Like the Tony Soprano, you know, Walter White. Like, it's just, you know, where it's the flawed woman that we also love is so hard to write. And I think that that was, I think you did that.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I wrote this thing for IO9 around the time the book came out about, you know, flawed female characters and how I feel like we need them. And it's interesting because I did a search when I was working on that article and I was like, okay, I'm going to look for like lists of like great anti-heroes in fiction. And like, I found a bunch of them that were like great anti-heroes in movies, great blah, blah, blah. And they were all dudes, like every single one of them. It was like Wolverine and like House and like there's just like a million dudes who are anti-heroes. Right. And like, you know, and I love that. But I also love Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I also love like, you know, all the characters on She-Ra. And like, I don't know. I love all of those characters.
Yeah. So, it's told in two perspectives, the book. Sophie, as you mentioned, she has the first person perspective and it goes back and forth with Mouth, who is the she's told in the third person.
That's right. Yeah.
Why did you choose that way to tell the story?
So I added Mouth as a POV character a little bit later into the book because I sort of felt like it needed something else. And Mouth is sort of this badass smuggler who's killed, she's actually lost count of how many people she's killed. And she's like, she's the person who always just like barges into every situation and like, you know, just busts heads and is like, she's kind of fearless, although that's kind of her myth about herself. And it turns out that she's actually not entirely being honest with herself about who she really is. But I don't know. I mean, I wanted their stories to feel kind of different enough and like stylistically different enough. And I had this idea in the back of my head that's never fully stated on the page that Sophie's story was originally written in Sias Fancy, the language of the city that she comes from, the super regimented, uptight city. Oh, yeah. And Mouth's story was actually written in Argulon, the language of the kind of Las Vegas city.
Yeah.
And so I wanted them to feel like they were kind of could have come from different languages almost.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, I was thinking about this recently. Mouth's story is kind of like a Western.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a Western on another planet.
Right. They're smugglers.
Smugglers and they're kind of traveling across this barren landscape. There's like betrayals and there's like schemes. screaming, and there's like lots of, and there's bandits and pirates and lots of like, you know, stuff like that. It's kind of like a Western. Mm-hmm. And Sophie's story is more like this kind of introspective, personal, but also political, maybe kind of literary thriller almost. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of stylistically and also kind of thematically different stories, even though they end up dovetailing. So that was part of it, I think.
There's also a really interesting theme of memory, and I don't want to give too much away, but talk a little bit about what is important to you about memory and what you were trying to portray in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been super fascinated by memory because we construct stories out of what we remember from our past, right? And like how we choose to turn our lives into stories is a matter of like how we remember stuff and how we reconstruct it in our heads. And it's like a well-known thing now that when you remember something, you're actually rewriting the memory in your mind mm-hmm. as you're doing it. So that's something that I've always been super fascinated by. But in this case, like with this tidally locked planet, like pretty much every creative choice in the book comes back to the tidally locked planet one way or the other. And I was just, you know, thinking about, like, I started out thinking about how would you know when to sleep, and that obviously becomes a big thing in the book. But also just, like, the thing of not being able to track the passage of time. Like, the sun doesn't move across the sky. The shadows don't change position. The sky basically never changes. There's no seasons. The only things that change with time are basic human processes, like people getting older, people having babies, you know, et cetera. But you know, the passage of time is much more invisible to the people in this book. And there is a thing in the book where people kind of lose track of time and they're like, how long have we been here? And they're like, oh, you know, a while, you know, and it's sort of this almost dreamlike thing of like not being able to tell how much time has passed. And that was something that I really kind of obsessed about because I thought that that was something really interesting about this tidally locked planet, that you would not have that instinctive sense of like how much time has been passing mm-hmm. that we get when we have like a sun that moves around. Mm-hmm. And so that led me to sort of thinking about how people think about the past and how people, you know, if you don't know how much time has passed, you have a harder time telling what's recent past and what's distant past, mm-hmm. which I think is a thing that people have trouble with in general. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that people often will decide that something is ancient history if they don't want to think about it.
Right.
But something's super recent if they do want to think about it. And so you have people who are still super upset about something that happened 1,000 years ago to their ancestors. But then you also have people who maybe were alive during segregation who are like, oh, you know, that's the ancient history that, you know, that happened a long time ago. And it's like, you were an adult during segregation,
right?
And, but you think it's an ancient history, you know, it really depends on partly your perspective and partly how much you want things to be still relevant in the present.
Absolutely. And your privilege too, right?
I your mean, level of privilege. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you think about, like, you know, right. people around our age whose grandparents, you know, had to sit in the back of the bus.
Right.
And it's
right.
like, oh, you know, I was surprised about that, a friend of mine telling me that. And I was like, of course, like,
yeah.
what a privilege to have not had to think about that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, there are still people in politics who were adults during segregation mm-hmm. and they're often the people who most think that racism has been solved in their lifetime.
Right.
You know, it's super bizarre to even imagine that. And mm-hmm. I don't know. So, and then, you know, in Sophie's story, the theme of trauma kind of comes up, and that's another thing about like the past and how the past kind of stays present and how you know, I think at one point Sophie actually says in the book, the only thing that never goes away is the past. Mm-hmm. And that was a thing that I sort of thought about a lot, was this idea that the past doesn't ever really go away. Like, you know, and especially if you are dealing with trauma, which both she and Mouth are in different ways, mm-hmm. It's something that's going to keep coming back. And it was something that I wanted to kind of think about in this book, partly because of, like I said, the tidally locked planet made me think about how we deal with the passage of time, but also it's just, I don't know, I wanted to kind of think about how when really extreme things happen to you, you know, you can't just brush them off or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So Sophie is the hero of the book, and she is shy.
Yeah.
why tell us your the background of her character.
Yeah, I mean, before I even really knew who she was as a character, I kind of knew I wanted to write like a shy hero, like somebody who was more withdrawn and introspective. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'd written a bunch of stories and All the Birds in the Sky and other novels where the main character was really outgoing and really kind of like barge into a room, start talking, you know, maybe get up and give a speech and everybody's like, yeah, we'll listen to this person, you know, and just super assertive. And I kind of was like, I don't know, I was a little bit tired of writing those kinds of characters, and I sort of felt like it's good to keep challenging yourself as a writer and just mm-hmm. to keep, and also I just, you know, when I thought of her as this person who went into the dark and learned how to communicate with these creatures that nobody had learned to communicate with before, I sort of thought of her as somebody who might be kind of naturally empathic, which doesn't, you can be outgoing and empathic for mm-hmm. sure, but I think that, you know, often it does go more with being a little bit more quiet and listening more. Like, I think it's easier to have empathy if you listen more and talk less. And so I sort of thought of her as somebody who was naturally empathic, and that kind of led to her being more of a shy person as well. But it was just really interesting and fun to write a story about somebody who, her choices drive the story forward. Everything she does is really important, and, you know, she changes the world, but not by being loud, kind mm-hmm. of. Not, and there's a lot of scenes where she's there, but she's not really talking a lot, and she's still kind of like the center of the action, kind of.
Right. And so when you're creating this world, you have this entire world, like you have the science behind it, and here are these characters that often care about the same things that we care about, and they're courageous or afraid in the same ways we are. How do you do that? Like, how do you make sure that that those feelings are authentic in the story that takes place so far in the future on a world that we can scientifically understand, but not that we haven't lived on?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge even when you're writing people on present day Earth. But it's always a huge challenge just to kind of make things feel emotionally grounded and to make the characters feel like they are people you could actually meet in real life. Mm-hmm. That's something I struggle with a lot. And like, you know, part of it, I have a whole like workshop that I've been teaching on creating believable characters in unbelievable situations. Uh-huh. Because I feel like that's kind of a challenge for genre writers, but yeah. also for anybody who's writing stuff that's surreal or weird or Kafka-esque or, you know, magical realist or whatever. And a lot of it comes down to kind of just summarizing the workshop, I guess. A lot of it comes down to kind of finding real life experiences that you can relate this back to, finding, make sure that the characters actually want something, that they have like desires and goals and ideas of their own that aren't just like what the plot needs them to want.
Right. They're not puppets.
They're not puppets. Yeah. Having them, you know, but also, yeah, finding real grounded emotional stuff that you can relate it back to that is, you know, maybe this same situation, but, you know, instead of on another planet in the future, it's like here and now, but like what would happen if your best friend got in trouble mm-hmm. and you had to try to save her? And like, you know, what if your best friend was caught stealing and you wanted to take the rap for her? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Just finding like the real situations that are, you know, that are universal, even if they're in this other place. And also, I do think that part of the struggle of writing a story set on another planet in like a different time is making it super grounded and making the place feel like believable, making it feel lived in. And that's something that I struggled with really hard. And there was like many, many, many drafts where I was just trying to add more just layers of detail and imagery and stuff to just make both of my human cities feel like places that you could go and hang out and have a drink or whatever, because mm-hmm. it was, you know, it's tough. Like when you write like All the Birds in the Sky, a lot of it takes place in San Francisco in the present day or the near future. And it's just so much easier to do that. Like to just have a story set in a place that you know really well that you could actually walk outside and look at mm-hmm. versus a place that you invented where you just have to like try to give that same level of like, well, if you go down this street, there's going to be that shop or whatever, you know, it's super challenging.
And I mean, just the levels of emotion, like there's times when characters reunite and they are, it's not just like, oh, where have you been? You know, it's like, oh, you've been around and you haven't told me, you know, like
right.
That level of that. I just think like, that's just, I feel like that is often missing in one-dimensional fiction, where it's just like those kinds of like, oh, well, you know, you just murdered someone, but you're fine now, you know?
Right. Yeah, that drives me nuts. Like, yeah. I will read books sometimes where people will, you know, do something really extreme, or something really extreme will happen, or, you know, their parents will die or something, and then they're just fine like a page later. And it's mm-hmm. like, I mean, I don't entirely buy it.
Yeah.
And I don't, depending on the type of story, depending on the genre, depending on like how fast paced and action adventure it is, you know, you don't necessarily want characters to like have to be processing everything that happens for like 10 pages, mm-hmm. but at least an acknowledgement that this is something that stuck with me in some way, or this is something that's changed me in some way. Like, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's like when Star Trek The Next Generation would finally break out of that, like, old kind of Star Trek thing of like, we go on these really extreme adventures and then we're exactly the same people in the next episode. Yeah. And they finally started to have like, nope, you know, Picard is still messed up from when the Borg turned him into Locutus.
Right.
You know, Worf is still processing this thing that happened to him 3 episodes ago. Like, even just like little references, you know, or dealing with it somehow is like super important.
Yeah, it's comforting.
Yeah, and it just makes me feel like, okay, I actually am getting to know these people better because yeah. I see how they're changing and how they're going through stuff. And like, you know, with my stuff, a big failure mode for me is often when I first write the scene, or even when I write the 10th version of the scene, people will react in a way that's like not natural, partly because I kind of assume, in the back of my mind, I assume that they know everything I know. And so it's like when, like, for example, in the book, minor spoiler, Sophie turns up after having been supposedly dead for a long time, you know, in the first like several scenes, first several versions of that scene, Bianca just immediately understands that what's going on is like, oh yeah, of course, you know, this makes total sense. You're back from the dead. And I was like, no. And so I sort of thought, what would Bianca think if Sophie just turned up after she thought she was dead for months? And I came up with this thing where like Bianca just jumps to the conclusion that's perfectly rational, that Sophie's been locked up, that she's been imprisoned this whole time, and that she must have just gotten out of prison. And which just, that's what you would think in that situation. Like, and having people jump to the wrong conclusion, or kind of, you know, not immediately just put the pieces together right, is much more human and believable. And I feel like I do get frustrated sometimes as a writer and as a reader when characters just kind of are too quick to figure things out, you know, or too quick to just brush things off, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So obviously Ursula Gwynn is an inspiration of yours, and Doris Lessing, I have also read, is an inspiration of yours.
Yeah.
What about their work has inspired you?
Yeah, so I recently reread a ton of Ursula K. Le Guin. I was asked to write an essay for a new edition of The Left Hand of Darkness, which was, that's completely insane that that happened. And so I reread The Left Hand of Darkness, but I also went and read all of her Hainish novels and stories, which is that universe that The Left Hand of Darkness takes place mm-hmm. in. And there's a ton, there's like 2,000 pages of stuff. And her stuff is just like, it's so like, I mean, the societies, the fictional societies she creates are so, you know, dense and layered and rich and have all this folklore and all this like, you know, backstory. And just, you feel like when you're reading about, you know, all these different planets that she's created, like Gethin, the planet in The Left Hand of Darkness, you feel like you're reading about real places. And it just feels like there's so much more to explore. Like on every page, she'll throw in things that you're like, oh my God, I could read a whole book about that. And she's just the master of that. And she's the master of like writing about meetings between cultures in a way that kind of catches all the complicated misunderstandings and stuff that go on. And she also has these amazingly well-observed moments of just like human connection. Like I was, you know, noticing in a couple of her different Hainish books, she has a scene where a man is holding a baby. And in both of those scenes, it's this really just rich, beautiful moment where all this stuff is going through this guy's head as he's holding this baby. And it means all these different things. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's really super interesting. And Doris Lessing, I mean, she was the queen of like flawed characters and people with like really complicated relationships who are super idealistic, but making terrible choices because of their idealism. Like, she wrote this whole 5-book series called The Children of Violence, which is about these people who are kind of Marxists in the 1950s. They think Stalin is like the greatest ever. Like, they're actually living in what was then Rhodesia, but they're Stalinists. They think Stalin is a great leader. He's doing a great job in Russia. They hear all these reports that Stalin's actually like a brutal dictator, but they think that's just propaganda. And meanwhile, they're all having like really dysfunctional relationships with each other. And, you know, and then finally they do find out that Stalin was not a great guy. And they're crushed and just like, you know, horrified. She wrote this other book called The Good Terrorist, which she wrote in the mid-80s, about this group of young people who decide that they're living in London, and they decide that they want to join the IRA and blow stuff up. And, you know, they're actually very relatable people who, you know, believe in what they're doing, but they're making horrible choices. And there's this one character in the book who's kind of like Sophie, actually. I wasn't thinking about it consciously when I was writing my book, but she's kind of quiet and shy, and she's kind of the main character, and she's the one who keeps them all going and kind of enables them to keep doing all their like very badly thought out attempts to become terrorists. And nobody ever really acknowledges her. She's just kind of in the background.
Yeah, so it's really difficult fiction. I mean, why maybe she wasn't didn't have mass popularity, but...
No, I mean, she actually did. I mean, she was huge, especially in the 70s and 80s, and she won the Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess, like science fiction, you know, like genre fiction popular, I guess. She wasn't really genre fiction, but yeah.
Yeah. The thing I love about Doris Lessing, actually, is that she did write some science fiction, and she just owned it. She wasn't like some literary writers, when they dip into science fiction, they're like, oh, I'm not really writing science fiction.
Right.
This is like, you know, and Doris Lessing went to the World Science Fiction Convention. She hung out. She just proudly like waved her science fiction flag. Mm-hmm. Even though she, you know, she won the Nobel Prize for Literature, she could have just, you know... She could have totally stayed just, you know, mainstream or whatever. But
right.
she wanted to own that science fiction label.
Yeah. So speaking of different genres, you're writing young adults.
Yeah.
And also adults, general fiction. Yeah. I mean, is that a choice that you make, or is it usually a publisher's choice about? I mean, because I feel like, you know, I read tons of young adult, and, you know, I know young adults who read, you know, your book. So
right.
What? Who makes that choice, whether something's young adult or not?
That's a really good question. And I definitely, I mean, I think that young adult fiction is really distinct from like adult fiction in a lot of ways. And you can tell when, you know, there's somebody's written a book that was maybe meant to be an adult book, and the publisher was like, oh, can you age it down like and make them teenagers and we can sell it as young adult?
Yeah.
And that usually doesn't work super well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell when somebody's kind of just going as a young adult and doesn't really know the genre and doesn't really understand how it's different. I actually made a conscious decision to write YA. I mean, my agent kind of asked me if I would be interested in writing YA, and I sort of thought about it. And, you know... Part of what made me decide that I wanted to write YA was because I'd been reading a ton of YA, and I'd been noticing that YA was increasingly getting like more kind of action adventure-y, mm-hmm. at least some of it. I was reading a bunch of YAs where it was just like, it's a heist movie, or it's like a caper, or, you know, there's Illuminae, which is basically like Battlestar Galactica for teenagers. And
Illuminae? Is that the name of a series?
It's the first book. I think it's actually called The Illuminae Files.
Oh.
It's Illuminae by God. Jamie Kaufman and Jay Kristoff, I think, are their names. And it's basically just BSG with like teen heroes. And
is there a Starbuck character, type character?
Not really. Well, there is a pilot, but we don't get to know them super well. I haven't read the other books yet. Mm. But anyway, so YA was just like, it felt like the kind of like super just like fun action packed, like we're going and having an adventure kind of mm-hmm. stories that, you know, mainstream sci-fi used to do more of were now being done in YA. And I was like, I really want to do more of that kind of stuff. I want to do more just like fun, you know, adventure. And so I came up with this idea for a young adult space opera about this teenage girl who kind of finds out that she's connected to this war that's been going on in space. And so she goes off into space with a group of other teenagers from Earth, and they have these adventures on this starship. And it was just, it was so much fun to write. And now I'm revising it, which is a little bit less fun. Revising is always less fun than writing. But my editor came back to me with some suggestions, and we're kind of changing it a little bit. But just, you know, it's very different from The City in the Middle of the Night. It's kind of like, it's more fun. It's more kind of light. And there's some darkness in there too, but it's like characters who are there for each other, who look out for each other, who are like kind of a chosen family, and they're like friends, and there's a little bit of romance, and there's a little bit of like, you know, cool aliens and stuff. And there's space battles and stuff, but it's a lot of like people just, you know, being there for each other, which is something that I really love.
And have you written the entire series or just the first book?
I've written the first book and like half of the second book. And I had gotten like halfway through the second book when my editor came back with like edits on the first book. So I'm kind of revising the first book, and then I'm going to get back to the second book. And I have like the third book kind of semi-planned out.
And are you also working on short stories right now too?
A couple. I've been kind of steering away from short stories while I've been trying to finish the YA, but I've kind of gone back to it a little bit recently because I miss doing it.
And you have you're writing a Marvel story also?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. That's actually due like now. it's only like a 10-page thing, but I'm having so much fun with it. It's basically like there's this giant Marvel crossover called War of the Realms, which is like basically like Norse mythology invading the Marvel universe. Like it's all the Thor stuff kind of mm-hmm. invading the rest of the Marvel universe. And they asked me to write like basically just like a 10-page story about She-Hulk for this like comic that's like side stories that take place during this giant crossover. And so, and I'd always wanted to write She-Hulk. I had been kind of like, you know, pitching She-Hulk stuff before. And so basically I get to just take like one bit of the story where She-Hulk is in the middle of a mission and kind of build out what's going on with her during this. And it was just super fun. I'm having a lot of fun with it. And like, I get to like write She-Hulk like smashing stuff, and it's exciting. It's really good.
That's so much. How do you work on so many different things? And you're done with your book tour for this book, right?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I'm still doing some more travel, but yeah.
How do you work on so many different projects at once?
I mean, multitasking. I don't know. I feel like if I don't multitask, I'm not as productive. And like, yeah. I used to have this life where like I worked on IO9 from like first thing in the morning when I first, like as soon as I woke up, I was working on IO9 until like late afternoon, early evening. And then I would go off and work on my fiction. And then I would go back and probably work on IO9 again for another couple hours and then like collapse around 2 a.m. And that was just my life. And I was like, I didn't probably get enough sleep, but I was just kind of constantly going back and forth between projects. And I had a bunch of other stuff I was working on at the time too. So I don't know. I mean, it's just, I feel like multitasking is a way that I kind of keep everything, you know, on the boil. I don't know.
We're told that that doesn't work, but that's what I do too. So.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
You're so productive. I'm going to use you as an example.
Seems to work so far. Yeah. I don't know.
So what's your process like now that you're not working for IO9?
Yeah. It's basically kind of the same process, except my time is definitely less structured. And I miss having that level of structure where there was like multiple deadlines every day. And like, it was just, you know, there was no time to stop and kind of, you know, get distracted or whatever. But I still kind of like, I like to take a really long walk. I like to find a cafe in the middle of nowhere in San Francisco that, you know, where I'm not going to run into anybody I know. And I'm just going to like sit in the corner and write for a few, you know, 4 or 5 hours and then go home. And, you know, I work at home some of the time and I work in cafes some of the time, but I build it around kind of taking a really long walk, I guess.
And are you not easily distracted? Like, how do you stay off of Twitter or?
I am very easily distracted, especially nowadays. Like, I mean, me leaving IO9 coincided with American politics getting kind of, you know, more train wrecky. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to not get sucked into just obsessing about everything that's going on in politics. I do have a program on my laptop, which I installed, that's like basically a blocker that, you know, won't let me go to Twitter or Facebook or certain other sites during certain hours. And unfortunately, it's easy to disable, but I try to leave it enabled most of the time so that I don't get sucked into just looking at social media, because otherwise hours go by.
What's it called?
Oh gosh, it's called BlockSite.
Okay. Yeah, because I have that on my iPhone. You know, it's like 30 minutes of Twitter and that's it. And
oh,
then I
that's
always
good.
Like give myself 10 more minutes.
Oh,
so
my
that's
God.
Like the snooze button.
Oh, yeah, that's a problem.
Let's see. I know that I feel like there's a lot of conversation going on in our chat room. I don't know that I see any questions. I see a link to your to buy your Outer Space trilogy. But if anybody has a question they want to ask in the chat room, you can ask it. Did you see one before? You were looking over there.
I didn't. I glanced a little bit.
But while we're waiting for that, is there any chance this is a series or is this it?
It's a standalone.
Okay.
I sort of think of it as kind of like a one and done kind of thing.
So we'll never see Sophie
again. I mean, I've thought about writing a couple of short stories that kind of follow up some of the characters from this book. Uh-huh. I have a vague idea of one that I'd like to do. Also, I have this thought that like maybe eventually, not anytime soon, but maybe like 10 years from now, I could write a book that kind of takes place like two or three generations after this book. And maybe Sophie would be an old lady.
Mm.
And like, we would get to see Sophie as an old lady, and we'd also get to see like how things have changed as a result of what Sophie did.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't want to write a direct sequel, but something that's basically like, you know, 50-ish years later.
Right.
Although they don't really have years, but,
yeah.
You know.
Sometime later.
Two-ish
minutes.
Generations later, following up where people are then.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And do you have any advice for aspiring sci-fi writers or aspiring writers in general?
Yeah. I mean, my main advice to aspiring writers is keep writing. Don't let anything stop you. You know, keep showing your work to people. Keep sending it out there. I personally benefited a lot from writing a lot of short stories early on because it was practice. That was good practice at writing middles and ends and like, you know, beginnings, middles and ends, which, you know, beginnings are hard, endings are really hard.
Mm-hmm.
The more of those you write, the better at them you maybe get.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, I don't know, a big piece of advice is to just try to make it a communal activity. Try to find ways to make writing not a solitary activity. Join a writing group, go to open mics and read your stuff to people, you know, get out there and like find other writers, go to conventions, go to workshops, try to do, you know, Clarion or Clarion West or whatever. The more you make connections with other people who you can share your writing with and talk to about writing, the better it's going to be in general.
Do you have suggestions for people finding a writing group if they don't know writers? What about an online writing group? Is that as good?
There are some online writing groups, and I haven't really tried them. I guess I was in one years ago. I mean, those can be really good too. I think, you know, just Google search, you know, go to your local sci-fi bookstore or your local bookstore in general and ask mm-hmm. if they have anything. You know, go to open mics again and see if you run into people. Mm-hmm. Go to conventions. I think conventions are a great place for writers to meet other people. And there are writing conferences as well as like sci-fi conventions.
Yeah. I had another question about your podcast, Our Opinions Are Correct. I keep wanting to call it All Our Opinions Are Correct because all of them are. But that you host this with Annalee Newitz, and it's a great podcast.
Yeah.
I really love it. And you guys were talking about Ex Machina. And
right.
I love that movie, but based on your discussion, I was sort of thinking that maybe as a feminist, I should have some qualms with it. So what are your thoughts on Ex Machina in terms of its relationships, the females in the women in the women and gendered robots?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched Ex Machina since it came out.
Uh-huh.
I really loved that movie, and I didn't really think that there were any female characters in that movie.
Yeah, I guess they're just robots.
There are robots who have been given, you know, female bodies, but
yeah.
I think from the robot's perspective, that's just a UI, or
right.
that's just like a thing that they can use to control people.
Right.
And the whole movie is kind of about this fallacy that these robots have gender when
mm-hmm.
they clearly don't.
Yeah.
And like clearly the Alicia Vikander robot, whose name I'm forgetting, she's clearly just using her, I think I wrote about this on IO9 at the time. She's clearly just using her like her female appearance
mm-hmm.
to try and control Domhnall Gleeson mm-hmm. and like to so she can get out of there.
As we all do.
Yeah. And so it's like it's very much about like how, you know, and it is about how people like the Oscar Isaac character who want to control technology and also are kind of want to control women. Uh-huh. They part of why he, I feel like, turns these robots into puts them into female bodies is so that he can control them and so that he can kind of feel this mastery over them and mm-hmm. do this weird dance scene with them and stuff that he, you know, he exactly could still do if it was like a gender neutral robot or right. a male appearing robot. But yeah. it's just for him, for his kind of like, you know, ego or his mindset, it's easier to do that with a robot that looks like an attractive woman, which mm-hmm. I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
There was a novel that came out in the early 90s called Virtual Girl by Amy Thompson, which I think about a lot. And basically Virtual Girl is about this AI that this guy creates. And then when the novel starts, he's giving the AI a body for the first time, and it's a female body. And the AI basically thinks of like this body as being a peripheral, is the term that she uses. It's like a printer or a keyboard or a webcam, but it's so much more complicated and it's got so many parts and it has so much input coming in because it's got all of the human senses. And then, of course, people sexually harass her once she's like in a female body, and she has to learn to deal with not just having a body, but having a body that people respond to in this really specific way. Mm-hmm. And you know, later in the book, there's this question of like whether other AIs should be given bodies and whether, you know, and she kind of takes a long time to acclimate to having a body. And she ends up deciding that some of these other AIs probably are better off not having bodies because it's just too confusing. And I love that book. I think it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Any other book recommendations?
Oh, my gosh. Like about AI or just about...
Well, yeah, I guess that's a big question. So would you recommend people start with Left Hand of Darkness if they haven't read any Le Guin?
Oh, wow. I mean, it really depends. Like, there's a bunch of jumping on places for Le Guin. There's the Left Hand of Darkness, which is amazing. There's The Dispossessed, which is, like, probably my favorite novel of hers. You know, you can also start with A Wizard of Earthsea, which is in some ways a lot more approachable. It's, like, the first book in her fantasy series, the Earthsea series, and it's a pretty easy read, especially if you've read Harry Potter. It's like it kind of, you can kind of tell how it inspired Harry Potter a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I haven't reread it in forever, but I think that would be a good jumping on point too.
Well, I think that is most of my questions. Have you watched Love, Death, and Robots on Netflix?
I haven't yet. No, yeah. I'm excited to see that.
Well, thank you so much. I want you to be able to write your Marvel stories in your second.
Oh,
and it feels like we've just been talking for a minute, but apparently it's been an hour. So,
oh my God, that's awesome. Yay, it was so great talking to you. I had such an amazing time.
Yeah, Charlie Jane Anders. This book is The City in the Middle of the Night. The other book that we talked about, All the Birds in the Sky, is out. This also has an audiobook with two different readers.
Yeah, which I was so happy they did that. That was so amazing.
Yeah, I listened to a little bit of it. Just I like to listen and read just so I can get through it faster. Read while I'm driving, not recommended. So you can listen while I'm driving.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So thank you. And where do you think is the best place? I know the cityinthemiddleofthenight.com. You have that. Yes, you can go there.
Yeah.
Where's the best place to find everything that you're doing?
I mean, charliejane.com, I think, currently redirects to the cityinthemiddleofthenight.com. I'm Charlie Jane on Twitter. I'm Charlie Jane on Facebook. But also subscribe to Our Opinions Are Correct, OurOpinionsAreCorrect.com.
And available in podcasts. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was super, super fun.
Yeah.
And thank you. This was amazing.
Thank you. And thank you for watching and listening and subscribing. If you're just watching and you're not subscribed, go to twit.tv/try and you can subscribe to that. I'm at Megan Maroney on Twitter. You can find me there. And we'll see you next week on Triangulation.